From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Every year, millions of people tune into the Super Bowl. Most watch for the football, but some actually watch for the flashy commercials. And of all the ads that will be turning heads this Sunday, the one making headlines now is one you won't see during the game. It's produced by the gay dating site ManCrunch.com. NPR's Sam Sanders reports.
The 30-second Man Crunch ad shows two guys on a couch watching a football game.
You suck!
They're rooting for two different teams. Then, they both reach for potato chips at the same time.
I wanna kiss this guy.
Their hands touch.
Really, really wanna kiss this guy.
They kiss. Rather comically.
We honestly did not think there would be any issue with the ad. It's quite harmless. It's not controversial. It's not sensational.
Dominique Friesen is a spokesperson for ManCrunch.com. He says CBS made his company wait almost 2 weeks for a decision on airing the commercial. And then, he says, CBS said no ad spots were left for the game. Actually, CBS was still selling ads as of this week.
I think the greatest disappointment is the discrimination and the anti-gay bias.
A statement from CBS says that ManCrunch didn't meet the credit requirements to pay for the ad. It would have cost up to $3 million. As a new corporation, the company has a limited credit history. ManCrunch says it offered to pay for the ad in cash, but wouldn't show NPR documents verifying that. CBS's statement also said the commercial's creative content is not within its broadcast standards. Susan Stastny is from Alexandria, Virginia. She'll be watching the Super Bowl, but more for the commercials than the actual game. She knows a bit about the ManCrunch ad controversy.
I wouldn't want to see that as a Super Bowl commercial, and that really is pushing an envelope of what today's society would, you know, be down with.
Yet, she thinks there's a double standard at play.
But of course, everyone likes the thought of a couple girls kissing, but they don't like the thought of a couple guys kissing.
A few years ago, candy maker Snickers ran a Super Bowl ad in which two men accidentally kiss while trying to eat the same Snickers bar. In the ad, the kiss disgusted them both. That ad was denounced as homophobic. This year, ManCrunch is calling on gay rights groups to boycott CBS and the Super Bowl. But the dating site is not the first business to have an ad denied. In fact, Brad Adgate, an advertising expert at Horizon Media, says that some corporations submit ads they know will be denied for the Super Bowl, just for the publicity of the rejection.
Once in a while, you see companies who want to get more bang for their investment in the Super Bowl by putting on ads that are they know are going to be not accepted by the standards and practices of the network.
Adgate says the big game is one of the last TV shows to reach men and women of all ages. And even a denial with an audience that big can be good for business. So ManCrunch might not have it that bad after all. In fact, since the ad's rejection, web traffic to the dating site has almost doubled. Sam Sanders, NPR News.
And executives from cable giant Comcast and entertainment company NBC Universal were on Capitol Hill yesterday defending their plan to join forces. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports.
The proposal is controversial because a major distributor would control NBC Universal's movies, TV shows, cable channels. Legislators wanted to know, would the combined companies jack up rates? Would non-Comcast subscribers lose access to shows they want? The answers from Comcast's Brian Roberts were mostly accommodating.
One of the reasons we want to get in more invested in content is we see the value of that content growing. We will be well served to make that content available to all the growing players in the marketplace.
The head of a smaller cable company testified that up to now, negotiations with Comcast over content had been difficult. A supporter of the deal from the Freedom Foundation said regulators should simply let the market decide whether it'll work. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. Childbirth should be painful, painless, completely forgotten, fully remembered, natural, surgical, experienced at home, and experienced in a hospital. At one time or another, each of those has been regarded as true, and that spectrum of truisms gives Randi Hutter Epstein plenty to write about in her new book on the subject. It's called Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank. Randi Hutter Epstein is a journalist and an MD, and she joins us from New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Is it fair to say that the overarching theme of Get Me Out is that the process of facilitating childbirth has been one generally of displacement of women by men and midwives by doctors?
No. Actually, I look at it as, well, two themes. One is, I thought when I started the book that driving ourselves crazy over conflicting advice is something that just baby boomers do, but actually we've driven ourselves crazy and been bombarded with conflicting advice for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I think the other theme is we've always driven ourselves crazy to try to figure out how to have this perfect baby. We're trying to control the uncontrollable. And in terms of doctors and midwives, I think we women have a history of being a feisty bunch. So we've actually pushed and asked for lots of things, too, some good, some bad.
Now, there are people in this story who made great advances and yet are still very hard to admire for a variety of reasons, starting with the Chamberlains, who made a great advance and then managed to keep it secret from the rest of the world.
Yes, the Chamberlain family came to England from France in the late 1500s with a forceps. Now, there were forceps before, but they kind of ripped the baby out and did all sorts of gruesome things. The Chamberlains claimed to have a forceps that could help get the baby out, the ones that were stuck, gently, without harming the mother or the baby. But they wanted to capture that market, so they hid their forceps from anyone, even from the woman giving birth, as if she was going to be taking notes and trying to figure out what that forceps was and make her own afterwards.
So they wanted to make childbirth safer for their patients only. They didn't care about anyone else.
And they wanted to be the doctors of royalty, too, and they won. They got that.
Another, at best, questionable character is Dr. J. Marion Sims.
Oh, yes. He's actually a much more controversial figure among historians today. What the Chamberlains did sounds really appalling to us now, but really, that's what all doctors do. They were competitive, they had new things, they didn't share information. Sims is the doctor who is renowned for figuring out how to cure vaginal fistulas, tears in the vaginal wall, which is absolutely wonderful. You know, thousands and thousands of lives have been saved. The part of the story that he always liked to bury when he came north from the south was that he figured out his remedy by practicing on slave women that he bought and stitching them up over and over and over again.
Using them as lab
subjects.
As guinea pigs. Guinea pigs, yes. Another dubious contribution to the history of childbirth, the development of twilight sleep.
Oh, yes. And that's where women come into play. That's where we can say this was not doctors saying you have to have this concoction of drugs. This was a group of wealthy women who read in a magazine that there were women in the 1910s in Europe that went into the hospital, and the next thing they knew, the doctor was handing them their baby. They were knocked out. They didn't remember, as they say, a whit about the experience, and isn't that wonderful? What the articles that were in women's magazines forgot to include, or intentionally omitted, was that the way these drugs worked, you became a little delirious and were kicking and screaming, so you had to be strapped down and gagged and tied to the bed so you wouldn't roll out, but you didn't remember any of that.
Yeah, this raises, as you note, the interesting philosophical question. If you don't remember the pain at all, what then is pain?
Well, that's exactly what I write in the book. I mean, doctors who knew better were saying this is not pain-free birth. And the women were saying, well, I don't remember the pain. So to me, it was pain-free. So it is this philosophical question.
Class has much to do with this.
Has everything to do with
it. When you're writing about the advent of the C-section as not just a medical necessity, it's all summed up in the title of a paper that you cite in 1908 by Dr. Franklin Newell of Harvard. The title of his article, advocating more cesareans for women, was The Effect of Over-Civilization on Maternity. Who were the over-civilized?
The over-civilized were wealthy women who spent their time indoors, stressing out over their children, dragging them from one activity to another. I'm not talking now. I'm talking about the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And he felt that they just were not as sturdy and hardy as those poor women in the fields who were able to get out and have exercise and give birth easily. So he just felt we ruined our bodies.
Yeah, the argument was that poor women, working women, rural women, might be able to give childbirth the old-fashioned way, but over-civilized women, educated, urban, upper-middle-class women, are just too fragile to push.
Right, and they had scientists saying, and not only was their lifestyle, but the more bookish they became, the more those reproductive energies were being sucked up into their brain. So they just didn't have the energy to do it all.
I assume these studies for you as an MD imbue you with some modesty about medical wisdom down through the years.
Oh, and you can look at things. I mean, we can laugh about what they said then, but it's not that long ago that when we were picking sperm and egg for IVF that we said, gosh, that sperm, he's swimming fast and straight. He's the one. And now there are studies emerging saying, no, the kind of loserish, crooked ones might be the ones that are best to make the baby. So, you know, someone's going to be laughing at us probably 50 years from now.
Where are we at right now, by the way? What is the in approach to childbirth? Are we post Lamaze?
What are women doing? Like to call today the era of extremism, because I think where we are now is, and I've interviewed, oh gosh, it feels like I've interviewed hundreds of women, but I've spoken to women who will say, because of everything we know and I'm so informed, I want all natural, I want to be at home or in a hospital that looks like a home, and this is going to be this wonderful, cherishable experience. And I've spoken to an equal amount of women who have said, you know what, we've perfected the drugs. We're beyond twilight sleep. Get me in a hospital. Get me as many drugs. I really look forward to motherhood, but I don't really need this childbirth experience. So I think among informed women, we're really at polar extremes.
Randi Hutter-Epstein, author of Get Me Out, A History of Childbirth from the Garden of Eden to the Sperm Bank. Thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Major snowstorms are set to bury the mid-Atlantic states this weekend after record snowfalls in December. Last month, California was awash in rain, and the Gulf states, too, have seen heavy weather lately. This is not just a run of bad luck. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, much of this winter's nasty weather can be explained in two words: El Niño.
Scientists knew last summer that this was going to be an El Niño year. And last December, Californians learned, the hard way, that it was no ordinary El Niño.
It was a wet and wild commute for drivers across California as road crews tried to keep ahead of a massive winter storm.
That report from the Associated Press was one of a litany on California television as back-to-back rainstorms inundated the state. The Mid-Atlantic got much the same treatment, though it came down as snow. The strong El Niño and the subsequent precipitation is a result of something that started thousands of miles out in the Pacific Ocean.
Ocean temperatures across the equatorial and tropical Pacific Ocean are somewhere upwards of 2 degrees Celsius above average. So we've had what we would characterize as a strong El Niño.
That's Mike Halpert, Deputy Director of the Climate Prediction Center at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Scientists at the center say this is the strongest El Niño since the 1997-98 winter. What happens is that unusually warm surface temperatures in the western Pacific move east. That changes the heating pattern of the atmosphere, which in turn pulls the Pacific jet stream farther south. A jet stream is a fast and narrow current of air that travels high up in the atmosphere.
And that jet stream is where we see a lot of storminess typically, and then we saw a very classical case of that. A super strong jet extended all the way across the Pacific with storms impacting California one after the other.
A strong El Niño also alters another jet stream nearer to the equator and brings more storms to the Gulf area. In fact, a strong El Niño plays havoc with weather from Indonesia to the Atlantic, but in different ways. Indonesia gets unusually dry weather, and in fact, fires in parts of Indonesia have been frequent recently. Peru, on the west coast of South America, tends to get what California gets, flooding rains. Halpert says storms are local events, and no single storm can be attributed directly to the phenomenon.
One way to think of it is that El Niño conditions the atmosphere for these types of storms.
Halpert also points out that scientists don't know yet whether climate change is influencing the frequency or strength of El Niños. Scientists say El Niño will likely persist another month or two. That usually means drier than usual weather in the Pacific Northwest and Ohio Valley, wetter in the west and southwest, and colder in the southeast. El Niño has done some good in the southwestern U.S., for example.
Nobody can remember seeing such a small amount of drought on the map. So this El Niño has taken a pretty big bite out of some pretty severe drought conditions that had developed last summer.
And by altering jet streams, El Niño apparently also helped moderate last year's hurricane season in the Atlantic. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Next, some signs that the foreclosure crisis might be entering a new phase, a topsy-turvy new phase in which homeowners welcome foreclosure while lenders try to avoid it. Planet Money's Alex Bloomberg has our report.
Mary Kinsley is an attorney in Tempe, Arizona, who works at a telephone helpline that provides legal services to people with real estate questions. And in the old days of the housing crisis, the questions used to be wrenching and emotional. How can I save my home from foreclosure?
Now, it's almost a reverse. I'm speaking to people, for the most part, who want to know, how can I make the bank foreclose on this faster? They're not taking it fast enough.
And these are people who could continue to pay their mortgage.
Yes.
Is that illegal to just, even if you can pay, refusing not to pay?
No.
So imagine, you bought your house for $400,000. Now it's worth $200,000. You might decide to stop paying your mortgage and simply buy another house similar to the one you already own, but for half the price. The old house, the bank can have it. In many states, if you do make that decision, the bank can't come after you for the balance that you owe. They can't touch your wages or your car. They only get your house. So, from an underwater homeowner's perspective, it's a strict cost-benefit analysis. You suffer a blow to your credit score on the one hand, but you get a far cheaper house on the other. But a recent report from the University of Arizona says that from a strict cost-benefit analysis point of view, this should be happening far more than it actually is. Right now, a third of all people with mortgages owe more than their houses are actually worth, and yet the vast majority choose to stay and keep paying. The reason might be that more of us are motivated by shame than math, at least when it comes to home ownership. Another recent study found that 4 out of 5 people think it is immoral to default on a mortgage. And this tension between foreclosure as a business decision and foreclosure as an immoral act, it runs deep. Mary Kinsley sees it in her office all the time.
There are attorneys who think it is not ethical, who think that people should honor their debts and pay them if they're at all able to.
Do you come down on the side of whether this should be, or I don't want to put you on the spot, but I mean.
But you are.
Yeah, I am.
You know, in law school, when you take contracts, they tell you that there are no punitive damages available for breach of contract because breaching a contract is an economic decision. And I think that we as a society have sort of attached some shame to defaulting on your mortgage when in reality it's an economic decision.
At least in Mary Kinsley's small sample, the moral stigma might be fading. Like divorce, another breach of contract that used to be judged more harshly, foreclosures are becoming commonplace.
There are neighborhoods here where half or more of the neighborhood, the properties have been foreclosed. And I know that there is social pressure and people still feel some shame about it. But there is a point, I think, where in whose eyes are you shamed?
It's possible the social barrier to foreclosure might be holding back a wave of defaults. And if the social barrier crumbles, there's no telling what it could do to an already weakened financial sector. Estimates are that by the middle of next year, nearly half of all mortgage holders will be underwater. Mary Kinsley says the banks are already starting to fight back through bureaucratic lethargy. She says in the old days, if you didn't pay your mortgage bill for 3 months, the bank would start foreclosure proceedings against you. Now, she says, people are in default for 6 months, 9 months, a year before the bank takes any action. And she says, this is also perfectly legal. If the bank doesn't want your house, there's nothing you can do to make them take it. For NPR's Planet Money, I'm Alex Bloomberg.